As we've already said, Reverend Sisters, tonight we've got Brother David Reed from the Alzowan Ecclesia with us. And he's to talk on Zachariah's song. And in connection with that address, Brother David has asked that we take a reading from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 1, commencing at verse 5 to 17, and then verses 67 to 80. So reading together from the Word of Life, Gospel of Luke, chapter 1, commencing at verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias, of the course of Abia, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. And they had no child, because that Elizabeth was barren, and they both were now well stricken in years. And it came to pass that while he executed the priest's office before God, in the order of his course, according to the custom of the priest's office, his lot was to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. And the whole multitude of the people were praying without at the time of incense. And there appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And when Zacharias saw him, he was troubled, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, for thy prayer is heard, and thy wife Elizabeth shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John. And thou shalt have joy and gladness, and many shall rejoice at his birth. For he shall be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink, and he shall be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. And he shall go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And his father Zacharias was filled with the Holy Spirit, and prophesied, saying, Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he hath visited and redeemed his people, and hath raised up an horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. And as he spake by the mouth of his holy prophets, which have been since the world began, that we should be saved from our enemies, and from the hand of all that hate us, to perform the mercy promised to our fathers, and to remember his holy covenant, the oath which he sware to our father Abraham, that he would grant unto us, that we being delivered out of the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him, all the days of our life. And thou, child, shalt be called the prophet of the highest, for thou shalt go before the face of the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation unto his people, by the remission of their sins, through the tender mercy of our God, whereby the day spring from on high hath visited us, to give light to them that sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, and was in the deserts till the day of his showing unto Israel. Well, with that introduction, it's my pleasure to ask Brother David to come forward and deliver us his thoughts on Zachariah's song.
Well, good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all here this evening. Nice to be here. Let's have a look at this this lovely prayer, or I've changed it at the last minute. Song or prayer, whatever you wish to call it. It's a beautiful few verses, isn't it? It's an outpouring. Someone who suddenly, their voice has been switched back on again, if you like, and in excitement of what's going to happen. The thing they've been waiting for all their life is finally arrived, doesn't it? And it's an outpouring of the most exciting things, of the things that God's going to do for him and for them and for his people. I took two readings because I think it was important to introduce both the person who was saying it, or the couple who was saying it, and also the prayer or the song as well. Because the two readings introduce not only Zachariah, But I also introduced Elizabeth, his wife, as well, because this story is about a couple, isn't it? It's not about just one person, our brother or something like that. The two good people in God's sight there, not waiting for God, but knowing that the redemption is not far away. In our last hymn, I couldn't help noticing this, in the last verse there it says, what does it say? Content to fill a little space if thou be glorified. And these two people, I know we're reading about them 2,000 years later, and they've become very famous in Bible students' knowledge, but they are the two people there who are just waiting for that, aren't they? They know the redemption's coming, their faith is there. If you come with me to Luke chapter 3 and verse 1. Can we start there first of all? Luke chapter 3 and verse 1 then. You've got quite an interesting verse here. It's a time marker. It's been used many times. And it says there in the first verse, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Idumea, Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of the Lord came to John. So what have we got there? Possibly five names, five people you could cross-reference against each other. So what's Luke doing there? I think what he's doing there is saying, this is the time. This is exactly the time. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are. I know we only found... they only found archaeological evidence of Pilate about 30 years ago, a bit more than that, 30, 40 years ago. But Luke is saying, this is the time. You can set your watch by this. Okay, it's exactly what I mean here. Okay, there's so many names here that it gives you an exact reference. But if you come back to the chapter that we're considering tonight, back into chapter 1, and if you have a look at verse 5 here, at the very beginning, Luke doesn't do that. So if you quickly have a look at verse 5, don't forget the first few verses of Luke. Remember, it says about him putting down an exact, he researching it, doesn't he? I therefore was carefully investigate everything from the beginning. And now here in verse 5, it says, in the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. Just one name. So what's he doing here? Why is he only giving us one name? Well, what Luke is trying to do, I think, here is set not a time, but an environment, an atmosphere in which these events were taking place. Now, there's been a lot of Bible criticism, hasn't there, of Herod's reign and Bible history here, and that the death of the innocents killed by Herod was never been recorded anywhere else. I'd imagine somebody's going to find it eventually, or there's going to be some archaeological research and they're going to find it. But nowhere has the death of those innocents when Jesus was born been recorded. And one of the good reasons why that is that compared to the other atrocities that Herod committed, okay, this was quite a minor act. He was an appalling man. He was the greatest tax collector, the greatest builder in Jewish history. But in his 37-year reign, he killed his father-in-law, he killed several of his 10 wives, two of his sons. The list goes on and on of the appalling atrocities that he committed here. There was a saying at the time that it was better to be one of Herod's pigs than one of his sons. You got a better chance of surviving, okay? So that's what Luke is setting out for us there, okay? What Luke is trying to say is, with reference to Herod, that this is the darkest of times for the Jewish people. And this is the time that God has chosen to talk again, to break the silence and talk again to his people after 400 years. If you just go back to Malachi, if you can just find the division between the New and the Old Testament here, and you go back to Malachi, as the last Old Testament contact, if you like, at the very end there it says, and let me just find it, right at the very end of Malachi chapter 4, it says, I will come and strike the land with a curse. Okay, he has done. Could he therefore be talking about the change in atmosphere, the change between East and West? When Malachi last had God's contact with his people, it was Persia, wasn't it, in the East that was dominant at the time, ruling Israel. And now, when we find God making contact again with Zechariah, it's Rome in the West that is now in control. Okay, a very different change here. And in Luke 1 and verse 6 here, we read that, or we find then that the attention of Herod, that Luke here is moving it from Herod to a priest named Zechariah, who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. He's got to tell us who he is, hasn't he? He's got to fill us in a little bit of background here. So the image has gone right from the important political man there, right the way down, and he's pointing down at Zechariah, isn't he? A whole new scene, and a whole new character enters the scene here. Okay, and it tells us, verse 6 here, both of them were upright. Notice it's both of them. This is concentrating on a couple here. Both of them were upright in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commandments and regulations blameless. But they had no children, because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well stricken in ages here. So the next line tells us who God made contact with. Luke moves the scene from Herod to Zechariah. If you think about Amos, the fig cutter, or Gideon hiding in a wine press, I think God's saying, you know, let you focus on these people. Don't worry about that guy. Look at these people here and look at their lives. They're more important. Look at their faith. These are people of faith. These are people, upright people. These are good people, aren't they, in God's judgment here. These are difficult times, but these are people living out of faith in difficult times, okay? And that's a focus all the time, isn't it? If you think of Hebrews chapter 11, it's a whole chapter full of people. What's their quality? I don't know what car they drove. I haven't got a clue what else they did. The one quality is their faith, isn't it, that stands out, that is precious in God's eyes. These two, this couple, have two other qualities, don't they, which is important. One, they were descendants of priests. Both of them were descendants of priests. They were upright in God's eyes, and they were living a good life in a difficult time, a very difficult time, weren't they? The Persians basically left Israel alone to some extent. But now, the domination of Rome, they were all over them like a rash, weren't they? It was a terrible time. And the New Testament portrait of a good couple here, in God's perspective, is a clear allusion, isn't it, to someone else. He mentions the fact that they were barren, the fact that they had no children, and immediately our minds go back to Abraham, don't they? And anyone listening at the time to the song or the prayer of Zechariah would have thought, he's talking about Abraham. Can you just come there with me to Genesis chapter 18 and 11? Genesis 18 and 11 to make the links here. We'll see in a minute. I've got an overhead slide with some of the links on. It might be a bit small. But 18 and 11 here. And we have these words, if you remember. And Abraham and Sarah were already old and well advanced in years, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself, and she thought, after I've worn out my master, he's old, I am now, will I now have this pleasure? So there's almost, you can sort of take that out and paste it into the New Testament here, can't you? The link is so clear between these two here. And later on, we're going to see in Zechariah's song or his prayer, that again, there's a direct reference to Abraham. He's the second one named after David. Okay, the chronology is the wrong way around, but that's where it is. So what happens this day? Verse 8, when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving a priest before God, he was chosen by lot according to the custom of the priesthood to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. Now, as I understand it, Chronicles chapter 24 is the verse. Is the chapter for it. I'm not going to go there now. But there were between 7 and 18,000 priests. There were lots of them, in other words. And they were divided into 24 different clans or different groups. Now, if I understand it correctly, on the day Zechariah was chosen by lot, there would have been around 50 priests waiting there to see whether they were going to be chosen for the call. So twice a year, you possibly had a 1 in 50 chance of being chosen. Of course, God's in control here, isn't he? This is a way of God to choose the right one here. And you would officiate at the burning of incense there. Okay? Now, there is a writing written 200 years after this, about 200 AD, in the Mishnah. And it says there that they cast lots to determine which priest would offer incense. And it suggests that the incense service was performed by a team of priests, a few individuals who won the right to offer the incense, the right to prepare the incense, the right to scoop up ashes from the inner altar, the right to remove the ashes in the candlestick and things like that. If you think about the work that was done in the tabernacle in the Old Testament, there were people preparing things, weren't there, and to get it exactly right. Now, I'm not sure exactly which one is right there, but he won the lottery that day and he did the job. He was in there on his own. He lit the incense, he ensured it was burning correctly, then he backed away, and then that's when it happened, wasn't it? Okay, and the angel comes to him, "Don't be afraid." Okay, 2 points about that. One is, at the moment I'm helping out with a discussion group, and it's called the Tabletop Discussion, and we're discussing things with another meeting, and we're discussing things, not particularly Bible subjects, but things, personal problems people have got. And one of the things I've had to deal with, or they talk about, is, do I want to live forever? Now, if you're going to be in the kingdom and God is promising us, do you really want to live forever? Well, the angel that appeared here last appeared 600 years ago with Daniel, didn't he? An angel who has been in the presence of God for 600 years. Clearly, existence in God's presence is not as life as we understand it, is it? It is not a continuation as we, what it's going to be like in the kingdom, I haven't got a clue, to be honest. But clearly, it's not life like this, and living forever is going to be something that's very, very difficult, okay? A reality that we cannot possibly understand at the moment. The other thing is, if you've ever read through the Bible, and you've seen when angels make contact with people, it always says, don't be afraid. For some reason, when an angel appears, it scares the living daylights out of you. One idea, and I think it's a nice idea, is that almost you're going from a timeless state with God, and you're now entering time with man, aren't you? You're going from God who is timeless, and then you're sort of ripping a hole in and coming through, and you're meeting a person. And whatever that is scares the living daylights out of you. But there's always reassurance there, isn't there? Don't be afraid, okay? And that's what he says there. The angel says he'll be like Elijah, which again is a reference back to Malachi, isn't it? 400 years ago, the last contact that we've had with God there. And then verse 18, I always find absolutely amazing here. Let me just find that for you. So after all this has happened, verse 18, Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure of this? I'm an old man and my wife is well on in years." Again, it's a reference to Abraham, isn't it? But why did he have any doubts? We can discuss it after if you like, but why, after all this has happened, can he possibly have any doubt that's going on? There seems to be quite a few people who come into contact with God's messengers and they sort of say, can you absolutely be sure? It's almost like a very human thing creeping in there, isn't there? Well, the name John that he's been told to call him is a Hebrew name, Johanan, which means God has been gracious. Okay, God has given us something for free, a free gift. And he's consecrated by not drinking fruit of the vine, similar to Samuel, if you remember, in 1 Samuel 11 there. But this is not the full Nazarite vow. Okay, but he was to be separate. He was somebody who was going to be different, wasn't he? If you move on a little bit further on, when he actually makes the utterance, when he calls out the song, we'll notice that it says there, that Luke says, his voice was immediately released. That's one of Luke's favourite words, isn't it? This word immediately here. He uses it several times in the Gospel, and he uses it in the Acts as well. And it shows, I think, God's decisiveness, his efficiency, doesn't it? His effectiveness. And when he chooses here, I don't think Zechariah had a rough voice, did he, for a few days and slowly got better and better. It just, like a switch, it just came back on again. And he just said God's words, didn't he? There was an utterance, and okay. And he was back there, and he was back speaking, and he was uttering God's word. And the first things he said, wasn't he? After the 9 months? Considering all that time that he had to think about it. And those other things. I'm trying to think who else it was. I think it's David, isn't it, during the 9 months of the child's... I'll think about that later. I think there's 9 months again, isn't there, when David suffered and he had time to think about it, doesn't he? Can you come with me to Luke 1, 65 here? We're getting towards the verse 65 here. And it says, when all these things have been going on, and if you remember, Mary has visited Elizabeth, and she's given her prayer or her song, hasn't she, back in verse 46 here. And in verse 65, we read these words: "The neighbours, those people in northern Galilee, were all filled with awe. And throughout the hill country of Judea, people were talking about all these things. Everyone who heard this wonderful, this wondered about it, asking, 'What then is this child going to be?' For the Lord's hand was with him." Okay, so people all around about were saying, "What's it going to be?" Don't forget that Israel was a genuine commonwealth. People knew where their ancestry came from, didn't they? You know, a TV program about who are my ancestors would have been useless in Israel, but everybody knew, and everybody was part of a genuine commonwealth, weren't they? If you think about the ancestry given in Luke and in Matthew to both Mary and to Joseph, they knew exactly where they were from, didn't they? And here people were talking about these two ordinary people, talking about the things that were happening, and talking about the miracle that was about to happen here. Was it a little incident here of some of the celebrity that was starting with Jesus? If you think about the first few months, if you like, of the Jesus' mission, it was a bit of a celebrity thing, wasn't it? People were, you know, the press, they couldn't get close to him. Thousands and thousands of people left their homes to go and listen to him at what he said. They thought he had authority. And it was eventually then he started telling them, you know, the really tough message that he got there. Well, anyway, that's what's happening here, isn't it? Mary's song a few verses earlier, she speaks about the Lord contacting the lowly in status, in the, you know, the shame of the high and wealth. If you look at verse 51 in her little prayer there of chapter 1, and she says there, "He has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their innermost thoughts. He has brought down rulers from the thrones, but has lifted up the humble." Okay, so power, authority, arrogance is going to be put down, and the humble are going to be raised up. And this is happening in the north, isn't it? In Judea, it's in the north here, in the north country of Judea, where lots of Gentiles live here. Well, Zechariah's song goes on a long way, doesn't it, to answer the question of who this child was to be. The structure, I don't know if you can see that from the back, it's a bit small, isn't it? I'm going to focus it in, but we can start having a look at the actual prayer now. We'll get stuck into this. But if you look at it, and not having dealt with Mary's song, but Mary's song has a sort of eternal and personal nature to it, doesn't it? But this one is more a universal application, doesn't it? Especially if you consider the phrase "his people," okay, to include those who are in faith, okay? There's a division just here in verse 76. This bit deals, if you like, with the redemption that's coming, okay? The first half, the promise, the redemption has arrived. And the second half deals with John's role in the redemption. So when he calls him John, okay? The other thing I've put here is look at the references to the Old Testament here. There's lots of, you can sort of go through these if you like, rather than listen to me, which is a fatal thing to say as a teacher. But look at the references. When he spoke these words, everyone there was going, that's Abraham. Oh, that's the one in Malachi. Oh, that's the one. And I guess for us, you can tell how good you are as a Bible student, I guess, or your maturity, and you think, oh, I know that one. There's so much there, isn't there? So many links here with it. The first verse, "Praise be the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come to his people and redeemed them." Psalm 72, isn't it? Can you just come with me to Psalm 72? And well, if you want to just race ahead and have a look at the heading of Psalm 72. You might already know what this one is. Psalm 72, I'm about halfway there. Here we go. So already they're thinking, oh, he's taken that from Psalm 72. "Endow the king with your justice, O Lord, the royal son with your righteousness. He will judge his people in righteousness, your afflicted one, with justice." So it's got the same theme, hasn't it? And it talks about the perfect king. So already in the mind of the listener, okay, Zechariah is saying, this is a song, okay, about a perfect king. I've got a student at the moment who I think he's been trained for the priest, a Catholic priest, and they call this a Benedictus, okay, which is the first verse in Latin, the first word there, or the praise be, a Benedict, and they sing this many, many times apparently in there. Okay, that's quite interesting. It forms part of a ritual that they go through here, singing not only Mary's song, but this one as well here. But it's first opening there is a blessing. The word blessing here is praise, okay? It's only used twice in the New Testament here, and it's also used in Mark 14:61, which is a very strange place to find the other reference here to praise. Of course, it's the time when the priest was moved by a very different spirit, the time of the trial of Jesus, wasn't it? The priest that condemned him. He said, praise be to God, and finally we've got you, okay? And it's very ironic, isn't it, that the two words there, praised, are the same ones here. There is another spontaneous song in Mark's Gospel, in Mark 11:9, when Jesus enters Jerusalem, and a similar word there is used, but it's a celebration, praise. It's not the same one where we praise, praise be given to God for something that he's given us, okay? Verse 68 then goes on, doesn't it, to talk about the redemption of his people there at the top, the redeemed of them. Okay, this is not the this word there that it uses, redeemed here, is not redemption from conflict. It's not redemption from a fight, okay, or you're being physically threatened. It's an intervention by divine intervention. It has the sense of somebody being ransomed, okay? So when he said you're being redeemed here, you're not being redeemed because there's a battle going on. Someone is paying a ransom to relieve you from being captured by something. Okay, that's the idea of it here, which immediately again is going to make you think about the sacrifice of Jesus, the sacrifice of the one who's come for us. If you turn over one chapter to Luke 2 verse 38 here, you'll see a very similar use of the word here, verse 38. Anna the prophetess here is saying, the daughter of the tribe of, let me just find it, verse 38 here. She says, she was very old. She had lived with her husband 7 years in her marriage and then was a widow until 84. She never left the temple but worshipped night and day, fasting and praising. Coming up then, at that moment, she gave thanks to God and spoke about the child who was to look forward to the redemption of Jerusalem. Looked forward to the ransom that was going to be paid to free Jerusalem, if you like, there. Okay. In Hebrews, I think, is one other reference to that. But again, it's that feeling of redemption here. Look at verse 69 here. Again, there's another Old Testament word here that's used, or an Old Testament metaphor, analogy here. It says, he has raised up a horn of salvation to us, okay, in the house of his servant David. So we've got the mention of David there. So we've got a link, which I'll just deal with in a minute there. And it symbolizes strength, doesn't it, that horn? It symbolizes strength. Can you come with me? There's two couple to look at. Deuteronomy 33 is a good one. You just come to me to Deuteronomy 33. Let me just find that. Unless you just want me to find it. 33 and verse 17. And it says there, verse 17, when he's talking about Joseph. And it says, his majesty is like a firstborn bull, a horn of the horns of a wild ox. They will all gore the nations, even those at the ends of the earth, such as are the 10,000s of Ephraim, such are the thousands of Manasseh. So this is about Joseph, and he's talking about this analogy then. It's sort of an agricultural analogy, isn't it? It's something we don't really use today. I think a better translation of that, E.U. Ryu, in his translation, he wasn't a Bible student, sorry, he was a Hebrew and Arabic student, but he wasn't a theological student, if you like. But he says, instead of saying raised up a horn, he's forging a weapon of salvation for us. Okay, so he's forging something, he's making something that's going to release us here. It seems a bit of a contradiction with that first word redeemed there, but he's forging something that's going to be strong, that's going to save us all here. And at the end of verse 69 here, as we've already read there, mentions the house of David. And there's a clear progression here, isn't there? From the heritage of Mary, not Zachariah, notice. This couldn't be Zachariah's inheritance here, can it? Or is Elizabeth's. Don't forget, Zachariah and Elizabeth were both Levites. So it couldn't be their inheritance. Okay, so he wasn't speaking about his own son. It's not until verse 76, is it, that he starts to talk about his own son here. Okay, they were both from the Levi, both from the tribe of Levi. So this is referring to somebody else, isn't it? And it's talking about Mary's son. And she has a lineage that goes back through King David here. So he's focusing on Mary's unborn child here, predicting that the son of David would be a saviour, a priest, but not after the line of, okay, Melchizedek here. And it would be an immediate allusion, wouldn't it, to those who are listening would understand it immediately. But John, he's a Levi baby, isn't he? Okay. Nevertheless, part of God's preparation for rescuing the Jewish nation. And in verse 76, halfway down here, he gets the mention, doesn't he? Okay. As we've already mentioned there. And it's got clear echoes here of Isaiah. And if you come with me to Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 3 here, you'll see what those listening to him would almost certainly have made an immediate mental link with here. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 3 here. This was to be John's work in rescuing the nation. And it says there, a voice of one calling in the desert, preparing the way, for the Lord shall make straight in the wilderness a highway for your God, for your God. Okay. So he's clearly making that link, isn't he, that he's coming before him to sort of rescue him and do that. Verse 72 also deserves a bit of a mention here as we go down. Where is it? Verse 72 there. To show mercy to our ancestors and to remember his holy covenant. Okay, so there's a strange link there, isn't it? This sort of chronology has all got messed up, and he's linking it back to a very different perspective, isn't he, here? Jewish writing, they don't really have a word in Jewish writing. They don't have a word for history. Many years ago, I listened to a talk, A Thought for the Day, by Rabbi David, whose name has now escaped me. I'll get it later, or someone will remind me later, who was previous rabbi. And he said that the Jews don't have a word for history. It's all a continuous thing. History is something you learn from. It's something you learn from here. And there's that link, that perspective here of an unfolding purpose is shown, isn't it, here in verse that you show mercy to our ancestors, remember their holy covenant. Their faith, their purpose in life was exactly the same as ours. Therefore, if you show mercy to me, you show mercy to the whole of their purpose, don't you? Okay. Of what's happening now. So, if you like, Zachariah is looking both ways. He's got a telescope looking forward, and he's looking back as well, because their hope, their purpose in life was exactly the same there. If you remember, in the beginning was the Word, or in the beginning was the intent at the beginning of John's word, wasn't it? So that intention, that purpose is still alive and is still working today, isn't it? And that's the important thing here that he's making reference to here. You could also notice that the chronology is a little bit messed up here, isn't it? So we've got David first at the top there, and an oath he swore to our father Abraham there. Okay, an oath that we still cling, you know, find great hope in, isn't it? That all nations of the earth will be blessed by the work of Abraham there. Okay, so the chronology there is not particularly important. Verse 74 there, if you look at 74, to rescue us from the hands of our enemies and to enable us to serve him without fear. Notice the use of the word fear here and the word peace at the bottom. That important thing there. It's not a peace from strife or physical violence. It's a peace with God. Okay? To be at fear there. Okay? To be without fear. The context of the opening section is the rule of Herod, isn't it? A terrible time, representing the very worst of human excesses here. But God is going to rescue to ransom those from fear even. The word enemies in verse 71 and 74 is someone who's hostile, but someone who's hateful of your standpoint. I don't know whether you have problems with people at work or college or school or whatever you do, if they're hateful towards you, but it may well be if you're trying to preach the truth, or if you talk openly about, you know, your work in a church or Bible, you know, whatever, as a Bible student. It may not be you they hate, it may be your standpoint that they hate as well, isn't it? And this will encompass us, hasn't it? Enable us to serve him without fear, which is a hope there, isn't it? Yeah. There's one small question against what John anticipated, isn't there? In Luke chapter... Are we okay for time for a few minutes, aren't we? So Luke chapter 7, if you just come there for a second... Luke chapter 7 and verse 18 is John at the end of his life here, isn't it? So the child's grown up and at the end of his life here. And verse 18 we read, "And John's disciples told him all about these things that Jesus was doing. And calling two of them, he sent them to the Lord to ask, 'Are you the one who has come, or should we expect someone else?'" Now, is this the grown-up child here thing? Is that same doubt that his dad had back... I know lots of people look at that in a slightly different way here. Was he looking for salvation from Rome, or was he a political release here? I think he very clearly here, when he talks about people without fear and the path to peace here, he's looking eternally, isn't he? He's looking at the fear and the peace that we hope for and the peace that we're going to find here. Okay, and in verse 75 there, we need forgiveness, don't we, from the real enemy. And that's sin here. Whereas for holiness and righteousness before him all our days. Which I think brings us back to the right way of thinking there. He then describes the salvation of the Lord. And it's not a military conquest, is it here? But a spiritual rescue. He uses several analogies. He uses light a little bit later on, doesn't he? Okay. Those to shine on those living in darkness and in the shadow of death. To guide our feet in the paths of peace. There's almost an echo there of Psalm 23, isn't there? Those walking in the shadow of death there. Okay. There's lots of little analogies that he brings there. Light, for example, is a common allusion, isn't it, to the righteous compared to those who work in darkness, those who hide. And Zechariah uses concepts that are found many other places. I've got a few here. Can we just come to Isaiah chapter 60? This is the last reference here, but if you just come with me to Isaiah chapter 60 and just have a look at one of those little analogies, Old Testament themes that he's bringing out here, little metaphors, and it's the first few verses here. If we look there, it says, "Arise and shine, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the people, but the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn." Again, it's God's purpose, isn't it, unfolding there. The Jewish day starts in the evening, doesn't it? It starts with darkness, and then the dawn comes up, and the light is with us. It's an interesting, the different way there, isn't it? Salvation will come not through force but through a spiritual growth here through the Lord. That word he says there, verse 77, to give his people the knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins. Okay, that knowledge will come and they'll be enlightened, given a knowledge of salvation, of forgiveness, of mercy, of peace. John's role will be to just preserve the way, and ends here, if you like, by introducing us to the way that John is going to live here. And if you look at the very last verse of this chapter 1, it says there, "And the child grew and became strong in spirit, and he lived in the desert until he appeared publicly to Israel." So now Luke moves the spotlight, not from him, but he moves the spotlight back to Jesus that we're going to find out about in the rest of John's gospel. I don't know whether you agree with those conclusions. Okay, I think that's what he's trying to say here. Okay, you might be, God's purpose is unfolding the lives of people in faith, aren't they? The peoples of Hebrews 11. Okay. As a person of faith, you might go about your daily life, but it's a nice thought that you're on the radar screen, aren't you? He's looking at you and he's looking at me. Okay. You might be suffering. You may be suffering the way that people were under Herod. Okay, we're still in God's, the darkest days, don't mean God has left us without help. Okay. And the other point there is that faith is a timeless thing, isn't it? There's no history, no example of witnesses. Okay. Every example of faith is an example to us, isn't it? Which is really important thought there. Okay. Well, thank you for listening. I'll leave it there. Thanks.